Part 5. Prisons. Chapter 1. In Rakava, beneath the high walls. The tune had stuck with Itari all the way from Eston, jolting in his head as he jolted over the roads of the Polana on an outside seat of the springless coach, in the wind, between hills that hid themselves at last in slow-drifting clouds and veils of autumn rain. It was in the rain that he first saw the high walls, and from the south. Coming to Rakava from the north, from the plains, one would see first a swell of land, a hill rising 1,000 feet so gradually that it could hardly be seen as a whole, and below, the long skyline, a patch of something like broken pearls, that as one came closer, would take form, becoming a walled city built of white and tawny stone, towered and battlemented, remote, magnificent. But coming up from the south, over the crest of the great hill, Itari first saw Rakava below him, exposed and dingy in the rain of an October afternoon. The houses had spread out far beyond the walls. The towers huddled in a maze and jumble of streets, dominated by the featureless bulk of several buildings that stood massive at the north edge of the city, the cloth factories. In older centuries, Rakava had been the pearl of the east, the glory and fortress of the province, the untaken, the unsullied, Rakava intacta. Now, the high walls were breached in 50 places to let in and out the swarms of men and women going to work in the factories, coming back from work in the factories. There was still wealth there. Industry was modern and on a scale unmatched in any other city of the land. Wool and silk was the city's wealth. Silkworms were raised, baled fleeces stored, yarn spun and dyed, cloth woven and cut in the huge sheds and buildings along the northern wall. The life of the city was there, and the old towers of feudal defence stood useless, like the rusty iron fingers of a gauntlet thrusting up through the chalk of a barren hill. The coach passed under these towers, and Itari looked up at their blind, massive walls uneasily. One, a fort, all but windowless, was the Saint Lazare prison. Another, next to it, higher and elaborately battlemented, housed the provincial courts of law. He saw no sign of use or habitation in the others, their dark gates barred. Dusk came fast in the narrow streets. The coach rattled down cobbles slippery with rain. One of the horses slipped, plunged, and went down with a sickening crash, leaving its mate straining to stay afoot in the broken harness, and the coach tilted over, so that Itali half jumped and half slid down to the street, where he too slipped, and so greeted the stones of Rakava on hands and knees, his head badly jolted, and his palms scraped raw. The horse had broken its knees. A crowd had gathered immediately and pressed in close on the horses, the coach, the passengers. Itari got the valise out of the boot and pushed his way out of the crowd, his head still ringing. He got directions from a woman and set off down the street to the Rose Tree Inn, where Isabar was waiting for him. An ex-student teacher, 19 now, and an ardent acolyte at Novesby Verba, he was very glad to see him. He'd been alone in Rakava 2 days, and had apparently had a wretched time of it. He talked all the time Itari had his bath, which was the first thing he'd ordered, a hot tub in front of a hot fire. Even as he finally got warm, he could feel the cold he'd taken on the rainy trip settling itself in his throat and nose and eye sockets, moving in, making itself at home. The quantity of hot water brought up had been meagre. The fire did not burn well. As he stood on the hearth to towel himself dry, he observed two cockroaches the size of his thumb bickering over a greasy spot on the floor. "No rose, this rose tree," he said. "The rats run up on the beds at night. It's foul. The whole city's foul." Itali shivered. "Hand me my shirt there, would you, Augustine? Thanks. Well, is it any worse than the Krasnoy slums?" "Yes, because that's all there is. The rest of it is dead, and the people are like rats. They won't even talk to you." "You're an outsider. You're not one of them. All provincials are suspicious. I know. I'm a provincial." He always found himself reassuring Isabeau, trying to cheer him up, making light of difficulties. It made him feel much more than 5 years older than the boy, and roused a sense of hypocrisy in him. "They are probably human anyhow," he said dryly. "Come on. I'm hungry." "I ordered mutton. There isn't much else," Isabeau said, despondent. They went down to a greasy supper in the gloomy depths of the inn. When Itali got to bed with his cold and a sharp ache in his wrist where he'd wrenched it landing on the cobblestones, he reflected that his arrival in Rakava had been inauspicious, and indeed that the journey had begun ill. Why had Amadei turned away like that, without a word, as if he could not wait to see him go? A rat scrabbled in the wall or under the bed. The air of the room was sour with the smell of the cheap tallow candles just blown out. "What am I doing here?" Itali thought in discouragement, and let the unanswered question magnify his sense of being in a strange room among unfamiliar walls and streets, until his own tired, unrelaxed body felt strange to him. The pain in his wrists and hand increased. He could not find an easy position. As his waking intelligence began to blur, the pressure of the alien and the inimical increased until he felt himself unable to move, lying as still and tense as a hunted man in hiding, yet half asleep and longing for full sleep, and still the stupid question hanging in his mind, "What am I doing here?" Next morning, he had not forgotten that night mood and could not shake it off entirely. Only the question had resumed its primary form, waiting for him among the stones of Rakava, as it had waited for him in a kindlier disguise among the fountains and gardens of Aesna, borrowing from them the aspect of desire or of longing. Here it was undisguised and blunt, a mere question: "What am I doing?" There was no disguise here, no distraction. Here in this city, whose existence was a suction of crowds into the factories and rejection of them, suction and rejection, repetitive, unvarying activity like that of a powerful machine, work irrelevant to climate, to season, to the land, or the hour of sunrise or sunset, or the wits or the wishes of any soul among the crowds. Here, Itali thought, after he'd been in Rakava a few days, he had crossed some boundary towards which he'd been tending for a long time. But he did not know where he'd come, or why, or if there was any way back home. He did, of course, what he'd come to do. call on factory owners and managers, used Orogun's introductions to meet the political leaders of the city, and among the workers, studied the functioning and organization of the factories. He was profoundly impressed by the men and the city, by the vigor, the tremendous inorganic energy of the system, which less than 20 years old, and only beginning to reach full development, had transformed the lives of 100,000 people. After a fortnight, he had so much material for a series of articles that he began to write them, calling the series, with an irony perceptible only to himself, Industry in Rakava. He was industrious enough. His mind worked with speed and concentration. He was tireless. Only he had to avoid certain questions in his writing and his thoughts, or they would lead him back round to the one he could not answer. And it seemed to him sometimes that his senses were dulled here, so that he did not feel keenly nor see clearly. His emotions, too, were cool, as if insulated off. Isabeau worked hard for him and stuck close to him. The boy was not the companion Itali would have liked. His loyalty verged too much upon dependence. He demanded that Itali lead and inform him. That Itali should question his own purposes was unthinkable to him. They were working for freedom, and that was all that was needed. Sometimes this trust was a comfort to Itali. Sometimes he was moved by it to destructive cynicisms, which he did not let himself say aloud. Perhaps he had no right to do what he was doing. Certainly, he had no right to destroy the whole fabric of Isabeau's beliefs and hopes. The days went by rapidly, evenly. They were well into November, and rain or sleet and snow fell every day. Itali put off his plans to leave. He continued to gather material for his articles. His understanding of the subject began to grow. He wrote to Brelave that he might stay until Christmas if their money held out. Under his steady activity, there was a lethargy, an unwillingness to move again, to go on or go back. He was here. He would stay. He kept returning to the factories to watch the rattling, grey-black efficiency of the wooden and iron machines, out of which came long webs of pure white wool, fragile silks, the colours of jewels and flowers, patterned velvets, splendid and delicate products of the looms and racks, the stinking vats of dye and sizing, the crazy dancing spindles, the endless trays of leaves and worms. The big new Furman wool factory had two steam-driven looms, the first in the country. He had read San Giusto's descriptions of such machines in the northern English cities, and went to see them in some intellectual excitement, but was drawn back to them again and again, simply to watch them work. The swift, endless back and forth, the deft, effaced men that served them. He could stand watching them for an hour, all the time with a slightly sick feeling in the pit of his stomach. They were the same motions. It was the same product as Kunoi working at his loom in his rooms in Melanostrada. It was weaving. There had been weaving done since the dawn of human time. Why did the powered looms so fascinate and frighten him? He wrote an article describing them, their structure, their product, and their probable effect on the economy, if more came into use. "What a lot you know about all this," Isabeau said, reading it, admiring as always. "What are you calling the piece?" "Freeing the Hands," Itali said. The workman, told off to demonstrate the powered loom to Itali, was named Fabre. Itali had quickly discovered the man's politics to be radical, and they had struck up a kind of friendship, very cautious on both sides. Fabre lived with his wife, his father-in-law, and five children in a four-room house outside the east wall. The Furman managers had built this row of houses for their skilled workmen. Fabre was an aristocrat and treated as such. The houses had floors and small fenced front yards, though the back doors opened on an alley of mud. The children played in troops in the alley, never in the little bare yards. These houses fascinated Itali as the machinery of the factories did. The slums of Rakava were like the slums of Krasnoy or any other city. That dirt and misery was old, coeval with the cities. The poor you always have with you. But Fabre and his family were not poor. They were not dirty. If they were miserable, it was not by the ancient causes of cold, hunger and disease. They did not plant flowers in those front plots or vegetables, which would be stolen, Fabre's wife said. It was not worth the trouble. Anyway, they would likely move soon. There were new houses being built by the east gate. Water piped into a pump in your own yard, they said. The company keeps us well enough, she said factually, and yet with a cold irony. Itali knew the peasant houses of Val Malafrena. More crowded even than this house, darker and warm. Opposite the hearth would be a partition, and visible and audible across it, the cow, and perhaps a couple of pigs or goats. The enormous bed, usually next to the stall, the clothes press, the table and chairs were of oak. Everything smelled of hay, manure, bedding, onions, wood smoke. Whatever the housewife owned of pewter, copper, or painted ware, stood out on a shelf above the table. One was not asked into those houses any more than into a badger's earth or a fox's den. One stood in the doorway, speaking to the housewife or the husband, the youngest children staring from the rich darkness. In such places, people had lived always on the land. The houses of privilege, Valtosa and the Sorde house, were the same house made light and large, and the cattle moved out. But this house, Fabre's house in the double row, this was something else. It was slave quarters. The company keeps us well enough. Itali saw them stand in groups on the streets on Saturday nights. Knots and clumps of women and men. Dark and forceful then. Null when they walked alone. He listened to their talk in the soft nasal dialect, always of the factories and politics. He saw they knew more, wanted more, hope for more than the peasants, and sense their violence, the will to justice too long outraged. And he wanted to withdraw from them, to dissociate himself from their impotence and violence, their inchoate lives, and the clever, inchoate slave minds of their spokesmen, such as Fab. He could not do so. He was one of them. He and they could talk, could understand one another's ideas. He could never be one of, or one with, the peasants of his home. The difference of experience and knowledge, the difference of privilege there, was too wide, and nothing could annul it. Nothing could bridge it, even except personal affection, personal love. But here, among these people, who understood what he was working for, he began, for the first time, to doubt his own purposes. If this was progress, if this was the future, did he want it? Did anyone want it except the rich, the powerful, the owners? In Krasnoy, Crowds formed and unformed easily. Coalitions and drifting apart of individuals. Here it was the crowd that was the center, not the man. And the mob temper was always uneasy, angry. There was little street oratory in Krasnoy, beyond street corner debates in the river quarter. Here, there seemed always to be a speech going on somewhere in the city, and a crowd around the speaker. The governor of the Polana province had forbidden public meetings. Any man seen addressing a crowd was liable to arrest and imprisonment, but it made no difference. They spoke. They met. They lived in unrest, resentment, wakefulness. They had all that Itali had sought first as a student in Sorarii. The sense of justice, the spirit of revolt. But then, revolt to what end? He let some of this break out one night, talking with Isabel. Whom are we really working for, I wonder? For whom are we making the way plain? The king, old Duke Matthias, a restored constitutional monarchy. That's a bit flat, but perhaps it's the best of a bad lot. Better than working for Emperor Franz and Metternich, by making an armed rebellion, which they can crush and use for an excuse to snuff our national independence altogether. Better than working for the Furman brothers, by telling the poor they can better their lot, they can rise in the world, so long as the Furman brothers rise on their necks, of course. Isabel gaped, scared, for he had never seen Itali bitter. But as the people become educated, he stammered. Educated. Itali jeered. But then he looked at Isabel, the fragile enthusiast whom he'd educated, for whom he was literally responsible. Forget it, Agustin. I'm in a bad temper. This place gets on my nerves. He turned back to the table and got on with his writing. A half hour passed. Isabel was restless, roaming around the room. They'd taken a two-room tenement flat, since it was cheaper than staying at an inn, stirring the fire, rearranging papers. Itali knew he wanted reassurance, but he had none to offer. His conscience was heavy. Isabel was a born follower, and he had seen himself as a leader, guiding men on towards the light. A leader. Had he outgrown that ambition, or merely fallen short of it? It was hard enough to keep the single candle alight in the depths of one's mutable, vulnerable being, against the indifferent winds of heaven. It was hard to stand up alone and know where one stood, let alone where one was going. The next night, he was to speak to a meeting of journeymen silk weavers, a strong association despite the government bans on labourers' unions. They wanted a report on the assembly meetings in Krasnoy, and he could not refuse them. Since his journal was prevented from publishing the news, he was obliged to give it as he could. That was one reason, perhaps, the best reason, for his coming to Rakava. Isabel did not go with him this time. His talk went well enough. They asked questions for an hour after. That was an ordeal, for lacking a politician's unfailing flow of words, he thought before he answered and while he answered. So he was slow, and his audience grew impatient. They wanted quick answers and definite ones. He got still slower, more cautious. He heard his own voice, dry and hesitant. The blood began to burn in his cheeks. He resented the men, sitting so patient in their worn clothes, the tired, intelligent faces, the minds impatient, destructive, arrogant. "Why don't the Assembly do something about the borough censorship, then? Why don't they question its powers?" a thin, persistent man demanded. Itali flung out his hands and laughed, driven out of patience. "Why don't they question the powers of the Emperor of Austria? Why don't they question the powers of light and darkness? What can the Assembly do, man? If it once directly questions the government's authority, the government will dissolve it by force. Would you defend it then? Do you want armed revolution? That's what you're asking for. Are you ready for it? We've got no arms and no allies. Yet suppose we rebelled and won out. Then what? What next? You know what you don't like, and I don't like it either. But what is it you do like? When there's no censorship, what are you going to say? He had found his tongue at last, and set them all against him. It was inevitable. They turned on him because he was an outsider, and because he was middle class, and yet they demanded that he offer them hope. He, feeling that to promise them hope was to lie to them, and to deny them hope was to betray them, stood answering their questions, fighting back at their attacks, defiant and sore-hearted. When the meeting broke up, one of the officers of the Weavers' Association, a man named Klenin, caught up with him in the hall. "Will you come out this way, Mr. Sodi?" he said, leading him away from the main door where the crowd was going out. "Are they that angry?" Itali said sarcastically, but began to cool down as he looked at Klenin's face, sensitive as were so many faces among these city workmen. He looked like Itali's neighbor in Krasnoy, Kune, the linen weaver. "They don't stop us meeting since 21, Klenin explained in his soft voice. "But lately, they've been taking up some of the speakers, different places in the city, and questioning them. Just bogeying. If they don't see you, then you're spared the trouble. You had to answer enough questions tonight, maybe." He smiled. "I let them down tonight. I'm sorry." Klenin looked at him. His eyes were blue, a soft blue, intent and serious. "The men always jump Krasnoyers, you know." "I respect what you said, Mr. Sordi. There's no use pretending it's easy." They were at the door, and Itali said, "Thanks, Klenin." He wanted to tell this man that he was grateful. He wanted to express the liking he felt for him, his blue eyes and fine, tired face. But all he could do was say, "Thank you," and shake his hand, the one human touch, the one meeting with another man of the whole evening. They parted on a dark street in the rain.